Welcome to the Jason Podcast. I'm Josie Briggs, Editor-in-Chief of Jason. Each month we talk about work in the current issue. We always hope this conversation will prompt you to turn to the July issue that's in your mailbox right now or go to our website. And this month we are particularly proud to present a special issue which focuses on racial and ethnic inequities in kidney disease. My guest today is our distinguished Deputy Editor for Clinical Research, Dr. Don Wesson. Don, thank you for joining me for this podcast.
Josie, thank you for having me, and I'm delighted to be here.
Good. Well, indeed, I have the great honor of partnering with Dr. Wesson to develop and edit the series on racial and ethnic inequities, which is the focus of our July issue. I think by and large, our readers and our listeners are quite aware that the burden of kidney disease, especially in the U.S., is borne heavily by African Americans and indeed by other minorities, Native Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Alaskan Pacific Island Natives. So that much is familiar. But our goal in this series is not to reiterate the disparities, but rather to change the conversation. Don, you have led the way in saying we need a new way of approaching these issues. What are we trying to do here?
Well, first of all, Josie, I'm delighted that the Journal of American Society of Nephrology is able to inaugurate this special series where we're focusing on kidney health disparities, particularly those that are related to racial and ethnic disparities. The idea is to stimulate further research into solutions to make our health systems what we all want them to be. We want them to be havens for the restoration of health. We want them to be sources of information that helps us to maintain good health. And importantly, for those of us who are engaged in the research enterprise, we want them to be inclusive engines for the continued generation of knowledge that will drive the enterprises that will support both enterprises of restoration of health and maintenance of health. That's the intent of this inaugural issue.
So you've often used the phrase, we should stop normalizing racial disparities. Can I ask you to expand on that point?
Yeah, absolutely. Josie, we know that many of the very esteemed colleagues that we've worked with in the business, two that come to mind are Keith Norris and Neil Poe, but there have been many others. They have rigorously documented that there are these disparities, and they've done so for years. And despite years of this documentation, these disparities persist, and they suggest to me that we have unfortunately come to accept these disparities as the natural order of things rather than as aberrations that demand correction. I think we have to change our posture from what I call this passive acceptance to one of active elimination. And this issue is designed to help us move to this posture of active elimination.
I like that phrase, aberrations that demand correction. So how do we make this transition from passive acceptance to active elimination?
Well, I think one of the first things we have to realize is that this is a problem that affects everyone. And I'm reminded of our colleague, Lisa Cooper, who keeps emphasizing this point. She says that health disparities are a problem for all of us, not just for those of us who suffer these disparities. So our society suffers the staggering human and economic costs of these disparities, and this should help us cultivate the will to overcome the understandable inertia to begin these elimination efforts, but also importantly to invest the resources that will be necessary to do so. Another recognition that comes to mind that I think we have to come to is, and that will help us make this transition to active elimination, is the recognition that health disparities, they're not inevitable. these disparities can be eliminated. This is far from an impossible mission and that we're taking on. And I like to emphasize, and others have done this, who have said systems, laws, and policies have created racial and ethnic disparities in the U.S. health system and its determinants. And so it follows that systems, laws, and policies can eliminate them.
Right. It is important to focus on solutions for elimination, but there remains this persistent pessimism. One area there's been real success is in Native American disparities. Not that they've gone away, but that the curve has shifted. How should we think about the solutions for eliminating health disparities?
Well, Josie, first of all, I love the fact that we're talking about solutions, not just talking about documentation. And so a very helpful step is to recognize, first of all, the embedded nature of these disparities in our society, including our beloved health profession. So as I stated, systems, laws, and policies created these disparities in the U.S. health system and its determinants. And so I'll add that these same systems, laws, and policies can help them to persist, and so they must be corrected. So again, we must transition, and part of the transition comes from moving from the common medical paradigm that attributes these differences in health and health outcomes to innate biological racial differences. We have to move away from that and move to one that, as I said, adopts this elimination posture. And this requires going beyond solely addressing the disparities themselves to include elimination of structural racism that enables disparities established by past social and economic policies to persist. You know, as an acid-base physiologist, Josie, this reminds me of how we teach about metabolic alkalosis. We talk about it in terms of initiation and maintenance. And I think we can think about health disparities in the same way. There are factors that past racial and social factors have initiated them, but unfortunately, there are persistent structural factors that help to maintain them, and one of them is structural racism. So that means the new paradigm that we have to adopt is one that redresses not only upstream root causes of these inequities, but we also must address maintenance factors like structural racism that enable their persistence.
Don, let me stop you for a minute. Before we get into structural racism and how we can see that, how we can help people understand the reality of that, I want to back you up to a point you made just a little earlier about biological differences. Is part of the point here that we should not consider biological differences as contributing to health disparities?
That's a great question, Josie. No, absolutely not. I'm not saying that biological differences have no role. We certainly should continue to explore them, and very talented researchers continue to do so, and we should encourage them to do so. My point is, however, that the data to date strongly support that social determinants of health and racism are quantitatively more important contributors to these health disparities. So that means that when we see these differences in health and health outcomes among different groups in our U.S. society, we should not automatically default to a biological explanation given the rampant social and racial context of U.S. society. That's my point.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point. I have to admit, having led some of the large genetic studies at the NIH, a certain sense of having learned this lesson late, I think our attention to genetic differences, and indeed our delight at finding things like APOL1 alleles, has really served in many ways as a distraction, certainly for the research community. These play a role, but the role is really quite small compared to the societal factors. So let's keep going on the topic of structural racism. You know, many in our health community, including nephrologists, struggle with how structural racism contributes to ongoing disparities. Sometimes racist policies from the past. Can you give us some concrete examples of structural racism affecting kidney health?
Yeah, Josie, again, I appreciate that question. So let's talk about them as these maintenance factors, as I referred to before. And fortunately, we can do so from publications from Jason. And the first one I'll talk about is one that's actually in this inaugural issue. Catherine Rizzolo and her colleagues published in this issue that Black and Latinx individuals have a lower rate than non-Hispanic whites of being started on home dialysis therapies. And if you remember, getting more folks started on home dialysis therapies is one of the goals of the 2019 Advancing American Kidney Health Executive Order. And these investigators recognize that major barriers that limit Black and Latinx patients with CKD adopting these home dialysis therapies consist of environmental and social conditions. And they specifically talk about substandard housing conditions and limited ability to pay out-of-pocket costs for needed supplies to support home dialysis therapies. So these neighborhood conditions that disproportionately affect Black and Latinx communities result from historic racist policies like redlining that force non-whites into these single ethnicity, under-resourced neighborhoods that create the context for poor health. So these are remnants of racist policies from the past, but because these remnants of them persist and have created these largely single ethnic groups, under-resourced neighborhoods that provide them with a poor context for these individuals to be able to engage in home therapies. That's an example of a maintenance or structural racism policy that allows a past policy to have persistent effects that will lead to these ethnic disparities in health. In this instance, fewer Black and Latinx patients with chronic kidney disease adopting these home therapies. We also have a second example. Last year, Jesse Scholl and his colleagues published in JASN three factors that were significant determinants of not being preemptively waitlisted for kidney transplant. And we all recognize the advantage of being preemptively waitlisted for kidney transplant. These three issues were Black so-called race, having non-commercial insurance, and living in lower income communities. So we recognize that historic racist and social economic policies have limited non-whites access to resources, including jobs, that would allow them to get commercial insurance and live in higher resource areas that have better health outcomes. So again, this is an example of past injustices that are so-called structured in society infrastructure that contributes to health disparities, and they have nothing to do with biological differences.
Yeah, these are indeed very telling and important examples of structural racism. The disparity in transplantation rates is really has to be a big worry for our discipline. We have an article in this issue on the racial disparities in transplantation in childhood. Again, this documents, but doesn't give us a clear answer, of an incredible disparity in accessibility to this most successful form of renal replacement therapy. So let's keep going. We've talked about some of these unsolved challenges, but there are some successes to talk about. Would you agree that successful efforts to eliminate the so-called race coefficient from the EGFR calculation is an important step in the right direction?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, Josie. This was indeed an important step in the right direction. But I would add, more importantly, the investigators who were involved in this, and I would highlight Cynthia Delgado and Neil Poe and their colleagues who did this, I think more importantly, they established and gave us a nice template as to how going forward we can adopt this elimination posture that I referred to earlier. So a number of points about what they did that led us to this eliminating the race coefficient from the GFR calculation equation. First of all, they gathered experts from our community in all of the aspects of the issue. They rigorously examined the existing data regarding this topic. They came together on a consensus approach. They opened their deliberations and recommended this approach to scrutiny by the kidney community. I like that. This group came up with what they thought was a good way to go, but then they opened it up to the community at large for their input. And then once having received that input, they published their recommendations along with a proposed path forward for continued refinement. So I love that template. And so I think it is one that can be followed as we enter into this elimination posture.
Yeah, it's really a model exercise. We often see prospective publications submitted to us that have aspirations for change, but don't go as meticulously as Delgado and Powell did in developing a path forward. I fully agree this was a real model. So any things you want to add before we close?
Well, first of all, Josie, I want to thank you for your leadership in this, just giving us an opportunity to raise the consciousness of this very important issue. But I would add, yeah, there are a few things. So I would say that I encourage our listening audience to read these important publications in this issue and to help us move forward in this elimination posture. But there are two specific things I would say. First of all, as I mentioned, part of developing the will to move forward to this active elimination posture is providing the resources that are needed to do so. And one way is supporting the needed research. And I think there are opportunities for the NIDDK and for the ASN itself to step up their game to support this work going forward. And then secondly, I would add that when we think about efforts to eliminate race and ethnic disparities in health, we often think about them being done by and even led exclusively by those of us from U.S. populations who are most affected by these disparities, that is Black and brown people. But the data show that with respect to advocacy, we're much more likely to respond to folks with whom we identify, that is to move toward the advocacy that we're being encouraged to adopt. So all of this is to say, this is not just an effort for Black and brown folks. White folks have an important role in contributing to this, not only in contributing to the work, but also contributing leadership. So my encouragement to those of us who interact with colleagues in the white community to invite their expertise, invite their leadership, and certainly invite their work, because there's an important role for whites to play in this elimination posture that I've encouraged that we need to move to.
Well, Don, I certainly welcome your reminder that we're all in this together. And indeed, thank you, Don, for your inspiring leadership on this topic. So listeners, look at your July issue. I think you'll find much of interest to read there on this important area. Thank you, and we'll talk again next month.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.